little while, and sort of in a way of putting closure on our on Russell Baker's book in childhood, and also to push you guys along a little bit further in your own childhood. I thought we'd do one more three right here, and obviously we're using our toys. But before we do that, just to kind of bridge from the music we just heard, which is not only reminiscent of what we experienced last night, but also what we'll experience when we're done with this rewrite. I just thought I'd ask if anyone has any particular kind of responses to last night's chanting. What was it like for you guys? Yeah, Tom?
I thought what the guy was saying in his introduction I found very true. If I did let myself get into the chanting and just start droning with the people, or droning with the chant, where my mind slowed down enough that I could find peace or a quiet where, you know, I was kind of open for communication with God, communication with my soul. So it was kind of a spiritual kind of thing, kind of, where as opposed to listening to this chanting now, we're kind of detached from it and not really into it, so this was kind of uncomfortable to listen to that, whereas last night it was kind of, it was there.
You were in it, yeah. Anyone else have anything to say about that? You can talk about it more later. I expect that after what we go through today, it may sort of stir up something that I found last night to be a real powerful experience for me. We hope that that to me is what worship is all about, frankly. I would be much more willing to experience things like that, I think, more often. Okay, what I want you to do now is you're looking at your little totem objects, because that's what these guys are for you. These little toys are symbolic toys, or you have maybe symbols of your symbolic toys, or you have memories of your symbolic toys, those of you who don't have them here. I want you to treat them as totem objects, because even though they may have been kicked around by various siblings and yourself from time to time, they are invested with a great deal of a part of you, a part of you that may still be alive in kernel form somewhere inside of you, but mostly is something you look back with a degree of sentimentality about, not always positive sentimentality, but certainly sentimentality. So if you look at a totem object, that totem object then has power. It is invested with a kind of power. Black Elk talks about totem objects all the time and how they become invested with power. They're not invested with power because of some great magical event that happens necessarily. They're invested with power because you give them that power. By giving them that power, then they actually have it. So the power that most of us have with the totem objects that we experience, as I said, is a sentimental power. It's not always, or most of the time, it's not a religious power. It's a significance that we experience in a personal way. And since most of us in our culture tend to turn the game down on feelings, turn the game down on that personal part of life, these objects don't have that kind of power. But I want us to treat them as that. I want us to look at them, and then I want to write about all the feelings that you get from them, all the things you remember about them. In these free writes, I want you to try and not be narrative. I want you to just have a string of words, descriptive phrases, maybe adjectives, whatever you can think of. Those of you who may have trouble at first, maybe what you need to do is just write a series of descriptive words that actually describe the object you're looking at. And that's an excellent kind of trigger for doing it. If you've done that and you still haven't triggered anything else out, that probably won't happen, but then repeat it. Keep looking at it. Take your object and turn it around. Look at it from the other side. Try and think about it. What does it remind you of? What was the room that it used to be in? Was it in a toy chest? What was that? What did that look like? What did that mean? Don't give me a story. What I want to hear now are just words, descriptions, a free train of thought. I don't really need to understand it when I'm done, as long as you understand it. You all understand what I want? I'll use the word understand one more time. I think I need to have another couple of thoughts. Okay, put those objects in front of you somewhere, or in your lap, or somewhere where you can sort of experience them. Give yourself about a minute to create a kind of personal space, a little envelope that you and your object exist in, trying to ignore everything else that you can. And just get into it. We'll give you about 5 minutes to do this, and then maybe a minute to recover before we move on. The experience is being somewhat fragmented. Part of the reason it may come off that way is because we don't have much of a transition often from one thing to the next. So if anyone wishes to sort of feel like, say, we've done this free write and you're still in that space and you want to talk about something that you've written or ask a couple questions, it's going to have to be on you to sort of help bridge these gaps. Some of the authority for turning this class into what it is will have to be on your shoulders. The other thing I want to say is I've talked to several people about doing an informal discussion group in the evenings to continue talking about some of the issues that we only touch on and hopefully just sort of stimulate you with. Maybe that would be a time to continue some of that stuff. Anyway.
Now that you said that, does anybody have anything they want to share with the group based on that? Come to terms with something?
Yeah. Well, when I went to find a toy, I couldn't think of really anything. I had a hard time. So I went through the stuff, and I ended up with this train and this block. And I thought the block was a little too basic. But I ended up writing on the block, and there's more to this red block that I found than just a block. I started writing about it, and I thought that, you know, to probably everybody else, it's just a red piece of wood. When I look at it, I don't see a block. I see a lot more in it because of the creative things I did with it, the things I built with it, kind of a world I created with using the block.
Powerful totem,
yeah,
for you.
Very powerful. That's great. Is it, do you feel somewhat sort of insecure that other people may look at your toy sort of disparately? It's not a good example for your childhood.
Well, I didn't know if it would fit the requirements that we're supposed to do.
Okay, I understand that anxiety.
Now, after having done that, does it matter?
No, not really.
I think you're beginning to get the first point of this class. That it's your, it's like any other thing, you always say that you, what you give, John Lennon to the love you take equal to the love you make. Well, this class is a paraphrase of that. So the power that you get out of any experience or your objects is equal to the power you give it. So. Anyway, if no one else has anything to say, I'm ready to listen to music.
Okay, before we get into the music, we have a transition period. And in order to do that, we're going to need to see the screen over here. And if you can move your chairs and someone could get the light, we'll use the projector.
You're just using the overhead?
Yes, I am. Try around. It works. okay, this arrow you can see is getting in off the ear, the ear, and this arrow you can see is being kept totally out. Now, the most familiar kind of screen that one can imagine with music or with sounds is that familiar sounds hidden and unfamiliar ones are blocked out. You prefer not to hear, or you prefer not to listen to the unfamiliar sounds. Now, there are other reasons that you keep things out. In our culture, very often, if there's a certain soloist that you're very familiar with, if you've heard this group before and you know the singer, it's more acceptable to your filter. You will let it in. If you've never heard this sound before, it's unfamiliar, so it's easier to block. Okay? Another thing might be if the sound you hear is from a very old scratchy record, it may turn you off because it's not well recorded. It's not clear signal. It's got a lot of noise in there. You may prefer to listen to a new record rather than one that every time you play it. Another way that I have a tendency to block is if the music is really very loud. If it's a little loud or if it's not too loud, I just like to turn it off or block it out. I can't stand that. Now, maybe some of you have some other ways of blocking. A lot of times, if the singer is not a professional, if they're just a local yokel and they're singing music, and you listen to a record and they don't sound the way Beatles are supposed to sound, you block it. Sometimes something is very repetitious and it gets blocked. Sometimes something that's very repetitious, like this arrow that's partially blocked, but some of it's deep in through your subconscious, has a sort of hypnotic effect with some very simple sign that keeps on being repeated over and over. Sometimes, if there's a singer and they cannot be understood, if their enunciation is not clear, it gets blocked. In this culture, we care very much about being able to understand the message of the song. In other cultures, the singers figure that, hey, everybody knows the song, everyone knows the words, and what they do with the vowels is more important than what they do with the consonants. So they'll go, like that, and it's the way the melody of the rhythm goes, rather than, oh, I'm having a very good day today, coming out in the lyrics. A lot of the people who make records, the mixers, will mix the sound or volume level so that the singer's voice is sometimes under the instruments, sometimes over. In our culture, we like to hear heavy drums. We like to hear a lot of accompaniment. We like to also hear one lead singer or one lead instrument. So we highlight the drums, the underlying beat, highlight the lead singer. We don't always have them blended so that they're almost co-equal. So a lot of it depends on what styles of music you're used to listening to. And if the music has only one singer that's going on and no accompaniment, it's sometimes very difficult for us to listen to because it sounds empty. It sounds weird to our ears. Now, what I'd like you to do right now is think about this cultural filters. Think about what it is that you let in and what it is that you block out. Because in just a minute, what I'm going to ask you to do is interview another person and find out, or do sort of a cultural filter interview. Okay, so you find out which arrow is getting in, what's associated with that arrow, and which arrow is blocked, which sounds are not getting in with that person. Okay? After you get done with that, I want the other person to interview you, so that you get kind of what I would call a sound profile of each other. Okay, so take a minute to think. The most fun in some of my music survey courses when we do this interview is to draw up a profile of the person with, you know, a little face and ears and arrow, and write in for them what music goes in and what music is kept out. Then do an RX, a prescription. What do these people, based on your expert opinion, what do these people need to open their cultural filters? Because a cultural filter, those grids that you have, are not preset, but they are subject to change. So as you go through life, if you keep an open ear, your cultural filters may open up and become wider and let in more different kinds of sounds, or they may get rigid and let in fewer. So as a doctor, as a music psychologist for this person that you just interviewed, you could do an RX for what do they need to broaden themselves. A second RX that you might do, and this might be fun to share with them some evening, is what would be too much? What would be shock treatment for them? What would be something that would just blow them apart? Now, if they're really a bad case, you may want to prescribe shock treatment later on. Why is this fun to do? Why is this fun to do? It's kind of a future prediction for your friend. And gives them a sort of a guide in terms of what they might like to consider or open up to in the future. So if you do take the time to write out and give them this piece of paper with your thoughtful prescription based on your professional opinion, I think it would be quite helpful for them and also quite loving. All right. I think when you got interviewed, you may have learned something new about yourself, not only in music, but some of your early childhood influences. And again, music is a metaphor for a lot of other things. It carries a lot more messages than just the sound, not just the words, but there are also some other aspects of music that are very powerful as well. Now, this ties in with Black Elk. Why? Why would we want to investigate our filters and discuss them before we get into listening to some of this Indian music? Yeah?
Because it helps you understand where they're coming from, because it's a totally different culture, and it's a totally different type of music, and it's something we normally don't understand.
Yeah, how many of us have participated in a ghost dance ceremony? No, it's really hard to imagine what it would be like. Okay, we don't have an authentic Sioux representative ancestor of Black Elk standing here in front of you. We don't have as many pictures. We don't have their totems. We don't have their costumes. What we do have is some very old music recorded even before the music we heard yesterday. It's really, really coming from the 1912s, 1913s. the hit songs of the Sioux. And you have to imagine what life was like then and what the recording, the field conditions were like then. People had wax cylinders, before records, before tape recorders, before cassettes, before microphones. And these wax cylinders were very fragile and they were subject to speed changes. So someone would be singing and the wind might be blowing and, you know, imagine the sound. Also, can you imagine carrying wax cylinders out to the Great Plains to record these people? So whoever was doing the recording, and there are some famous people in music or ethnomusicology, as we call it, who did this, we can thank them today. Also, we can thank the people who re-recorded off the wax cylinders and sort of fixed them up so that we can hear them on records today. It's an amazing process. So what you're hearing is some ancient totems from the Sioux and from other Indians as well. Before we get into listening, we want to do one more thing, and that is take a look at this map. This is kind of a funny way of looking at North America, but in terms of a musician's point of view, these are major regions of musical styles in the indigenous cultures of the Americas, North America. So you have here where we're living in, the Northwest Coast Indians, and obviously they don't include all the tribes, the Pacul, Belkula, et cetera, are not all listed in here. This just is a few of the more famous ones. The Eskimo, and this is Canada here. You can see here the Great Lakes. So our U.S. borders run right along here, along with the Chippewa. So the Great Plains spread up not only through the U.S., but also into Canada. And here you see right in the center of the Great Plains area, the Sioux, which is the Black Elk. Also the Arapaho, the Crow, the Pawnee, the Comanche. So you have a lot of movement back and forth across the border as well as north and south. As you remember in the book, they did a tremendous amount of traveling. Also, you'll notice here down at the very bottom it says Pueblo, and all of these little dots in the middle of Navajo country are Pueblo, and down here is all Pueblo. So you have a really wild mixture of tribes set in the middle as isolated islands among other tribes. And then the eastern woodlands out here, more of your Huron, Iroquois, Delaware. So these folks are separated by the mountains here. These folks are separated by the mountains here. But in between, there's a tremendous flux. So when you see this line, that means that all these tribes had similar music styles. They may have borrowed from other people. And what you'll hear is the ghost dance that was started by some of the people in the Sioux tribe, spreading to other tribes during the late 1800s. So you didn't have just one tribe keeping their own musical style. Okay, the other thing you need to understand is the people who use the music, their music was not an isolated end in itself. In our culture, music is an art form and it's often appreciated for itself. That is, we sit in a concert hall and we stay still and we listen to the music coming in our ears, or we go to a rock band and we may dance to it. But it's an isolated part in our life. We don't do rock music all day long. But for the Indians, it was very utilitarian. It was a means to an end. That is, music was part of their beliefs. They lived their beliefs. Music was part of their customs. They lived their customs. Music was part of their culture. It was integrated in. So it's important to know not the aesthetics of Indian music per se, and Sioux Indian music in particular, but the purpose of each piece, how it functioned. Another thing that's important to know is what they recorded on wax cylinders was a tiny little morsel. So when you hear a war dance or a ghost dance, it's only a part of a very large ceremony that may have gone on all night long. So you have to understand that it was only a very small part of a much larger ceremony. And what you have to fill in for yourself is not only that time sense, that ongoing time sense of all night long celebration, but also what they wore and what the purpose was. Now, often the function of music was to mourn the dead. Often it was to gain power over animals. Often it was to bring victory. But music was also used to make children sleep or to gain a lover. In other words, just every aspect of their culture was a very powerful purpose to it. Some of the songs that you're going to hear are recorded of people who are not gifted singers. Okay? And all the people that you listen to were recorded because they were especially revered. They knew a song, it was their song, it had a special purpose for them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that their voice was good. Sometimes their voices are very worn out because they're very old and tired. But the Indians feel that a very beautiful song that's very potent, sung by someone with a worn out voice, is very valuable. So you have to also put that into your cultural filters. Also, you have to remember that some of the sounds, it's like you're listening down a long tunnel of time. And you have to put yourself out on the plains and pretend that all those scratchies on the wax cylinder don't exist and try and figure out what the aliens want. Last but not least, when you hear the drum, Black Elk states in his feeling is that the drum mind and makes men feel the mystery and power of things. The drum is offering to the spirit of the world. So the drum playing very repetitiously in the background is a very powerful symbol for those people. Okay, I have some transparencies because I think it might help you to follow what's going on. This first one is Teton Sioux, clear the way. In the sacred manner I come, the earth is mine. Maybe you can read some of the background while I put it out. It's going to be followed while I just move it up here by the flute song at the bottom, so there'll be no break.
One last quick thing I want to say in terms of helping you have a contemporary analogy to this. oftentimes when they're listening to these singers, they're listening to them because they describe this particular person with a great deal of spiritual awareness. It's almost like people who have a great admiration for Old Blue Eyes, Mr. Frank Sinatra himself, will go miles and miles to hear him sing, even though he doesn't sing anywhere near as well as he used to, simply because their whole past, their lives, they ascribe all this sort of awareness. It's not exactly spiritual, but in some ways it's analogous. So when you're listening to this person, imagine that this is a revered, very revered, highly spiritual individual who is helping you understand some deep truths.
Can you see the words? Okay, good. All right, again, try and open up your cultural filters to let the sound come in rather than block.
To ask for the wind or anything,
can I say? Definitely.
Okay, that's, I met him approaching the ghost dance.
Yeah.
Maybe there are some of you can't see that, but
yeah.
This is a trance vision of a dancer, and this ties in with the Messiah, the ghost army, trying to get all the ancestors to swell the ranks of the living to ensure the truth of the white. This is an Arapaho ghost dance, but it's going to tie in with a Sioux ghost dance.
Thank you.
work of the past and its rarity among North American Indians today suggests that it may never have been as common in their musical cultural as is generally believed. The technique of flute making and flute playing, more involved and intricate than that of drum making and drum playing, is practiced by the Indians. We tend to limit the instrument to a small group of specialized musicians. The great flute makers and flute players are gone, and we are especially fortunate in preserving here one of the flute melodies played by John Kola. The upward interval of the sixth, the regular phrases and the words, perhaps reflecting the influence of white culture, leads one to date the song the last half of the 19th century. Thanks.
Probably because there was the flute going and the drums. It's hard to pick up a rhythm or some kind of. It sounded like they were all. It sounded kind of like freeform jazz today or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and you have to imagine they're all dancing and lots of stuff going on besides the
one meter
or one
organ. I didn't really, Adam, the last two songs I didn't really like because when I think of people stereotyping the Indian culture, that's kind of what I think about. And I kept saying, gosh, this is what the white man thinks about, you know, the Native Americans. And I kind of liked some more of the first ones because they're things I've never heard before, and I kind of felt like I was more of the culture and not just a white person.
It's very intriguing. The rest of this record, and when you listen to the Hopi Indians, the way they sing and the instruments they have are totally different. So we do have problems listening beyond the stereotype because the Sioux war dance is very often used in movies, whatever. And usually they just go thump, 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 thump. They're not used to hearing people playing at different levels of time. Okay, I think after the break we'll listen to Heinen with Growing Up. That we'll listen to some Indians at a just taking an oral auditory break and have some music from other cultures wash in your ears. We've got music from South America, Peru, Greek Isle,
contemporary Japan,
meditation tapes. We have music of the Balkans, Greek, Bielo-Russians. We have some really incredible tapes from many different countries, many different cultures. I have a lot of very good ones on the Navajo, as well as some urban black American music. And again, we have the World War II records and other records if you like to listen to those. So feel free, if you're interested in other Indian cultures, just checking out what the Hopi sound like, feel free to bug me. Okay, the next piece we're going to listen to is also a Plains tribe. It's not the Sioux, it's the Cree. But it's a World War II song sung by George Nicotine and the group with a hand drum. As the process of acculturization continues, or acculturation continues, the Indian is producing an increasing number of songs in English rather than in his native tongue. Each year brings a new crop of powwow love songs in English. And during World War II, with so many Indians in the armed forces, it seemed more natural to tell their exploits in English. Similar songs from World War I period are all in Cree. The words to this World War II song are, oh, brave soldier boy, on the land, on the sea, and in the air, in Japan, Tokyo. Just the same, I'm staying with you. This song, it's very hard to hear the English words until about midway, so you just have to let yourself float and listen. And remember that it's a World War II recording. After that, we're going to hear a warrior death song for Sitting Bull. This is with a bass drum, and also there are leg bells, so they tie this big strap with the bells around their legs, so while they're dancing, you can hear the rhythm of the bells. News of Sitting Bull's exploits had reached the Canadian Plains tribes long before his visits to Wood Mountain, the Cypress Hills, and Qu'Appelle Valley in 1877. A previous visit had taken him to Blackfoot Country to visit the renowned Chief Crowfoot. As a result of Sitting Bull's flight to Canada in 1876, several hundred descendants of his original band are now living on a Sioux reserve in southern Manitoba. When news of his death in 1890 reached his Canadian friends, a general spirit of mourning spread throughout the region, especially among those tribes with whom he had had intimate contact. This song was recorded at an Indian pageant in Fort Qu'Appelle near the site of Sitting Bull's visit. So it's a death song for a warrior, and it's specifically the death song for Sitting Bull. So we'll start off with the Cree song, World War II, O Brave Soldier Boy, and then we'll move into the warrior death song for Sitting Bull. And both of these were recorded out in the field, so there probably are a few scratches and wind noises and everything else. So bear that in mind with your cultural filters.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want people to be responding to this music?
Do you feel comfortable free writing, or would you rather just listen? It's up to you.
I'd rather just listen and then
respond. Whatever.
Thank you.
this ties in with Black Elk in terms of the discussion that we will have later about death. And also, I think the World War II song ties in with the Russell Baker book, the World War II experience from the Indian point of view. Also, that it's sort of a tie, a love song, ties in with some of the war songs that we heard yesterday. Any impressions or feelings that you'd like to share from listening? Christine?
The last song, just thinking about it being a death song, it made it really powerful to me. It made it mean a lot more to know that it was a death song.
Oh, was it that it was a death song? I mean, a death song for one of us would be really sad and slow and mournful and everything, but for the Indians, it's death is a time where they get to go to where they're really supposed to be. This life is it's like the Shadowland, and when they die, they get to be, I mean, Sitting Bull is obviously going to be with the great-grandfathers, and so the song it's not mournful, it's kind of anxious, it's kind of, you know, he's there type thing. It's not...
It's the transition.
Yeah, it's just an interesting difference between the different views of death.
I really thought I heard something like almost like a peace and almost like a happiness out of it, because I mean, I think it's death, but like she was saying, but I actually almost thought I heard this more happiness and getting more.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't know if this is weird, but when there that loud pounding sound that was going on, the bass drum, and then the little yelps and stuff, kind of to me it seemed like the yelps were kind of reaching out to the earth and the animals. Mm-hmm. Then the big pounding drum was kind of communicating the earth's presence and going outwards to the unknown and trying to bring it in together as a whole.
A lot of times it's hard for us to listen to their singing as being good or interesting to us. They use what we call glottal, a lot of sort of harsh sounds. And especially for men, I think it's hard to listen to those Indians singing with a high range in their voice, especially knowing that they're male. So there's a sort of a filter that we have there that we have to overcome. And this high range and also the sort of piercing quality. You have to remember what they're doing. They're dancing at the same time. And they're also fitting in the dance with part of the larger ceremony. Last but not least, I think it's very interesting for us to know that the ghost dances, which Sitting Bull and Black Elk participated in, were outlawed by the government in 1881. So they were forbidden to call back their ancestors to help them in destroying the whites. And what came after were different blends of religion. One of the most interesting is the peyote cult. And this is then called also the Native American Church, which exists throughout the Great Plains and other areas. It represents a blending of Christian symbolism and beliefs with rituals and practices of Native American religions. During the past century, this religion has spread from tribe to tribe, adjusting its practice to the culture of various tribes, while adhering to a central core of belief and ceremony. At the night-long meetings of this cult, the central feature of the service is a ceremonial eating of the peyote, the seed pod of a cactus imported from the Southwest, which the Indians identify with the supreme being. The ecstatic trance induced by eating of peyote is supplemented by the hypnotic music, which plays such an important role in the ceremony. Again, you'll hear a lot of repetition, which is to continue or induce a hypnotic trance. This music, again, is functioning very powerfully as part of the ceremony, which is the Native American church, Christian symbolism plus the Indian beliefs tied in together. So this, if you are able to sometime, somewhere in the Great Plains, you may be able to hear something going on like this, because it's going on today. So it brings us right up to the present time. It's continued from way back in the 1880s.
about Black Elk, the whole book, the whole experience of Native Americans, the whole experience, in fact, of what Nazi Germany did. They're the same Western culture in many ways, doing the same thing. How that world exists inside us, how it works in that sense, how it may be existing around us even today. Okay? It's hard to understand, primarily because we all are so immersed in our particular cultural point of view, that the only way we can understand how it functions in an internal way is to see it projected on the external world. So we look now at what, when you think about our cultural ancestors in America, the middle class folks, how they went out and they were frontiers people and they were brave and they went in, subdued the land and created this great nation that fought for good and wore the white hats and all the rest of that stuff, which there is truth in, but it is a myth in the sense that it also did other things to other people. It destroyed the land that it conquered. It destroyed the people that they met. And that doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's a culture or a people that do something in a great way, do something in small ways. Talk about big debts and small debts. There are big metaphors and small metaphors. So what I'm asking is to think about ways that that culture then projects the same attitude in ourselves. One thing that it does, and I think it's what the book on the taboo against knowing who you are does, is it disempowers the part of us that is deeply personal. Dreams is what we're going to talk about later. And I want to talk about a little bit of that now because Betty is going to share with us about dreams. Most of the attitudes we have about dreams are basically that they don't mean much, or if they mean something, it's just sort of something we have to overcome, it's something we didn't quite finish up before. It's nothing we take very seriously. Consequently, our rational mind, the way we look at things, causal relationships, A following B, being able to understand things scientifically is the only way we have of experiencing the world. Most of our education denies anything else. The only time we are allowed any freedom is when we're very young, because then we haven't developed language yet. What does our culture do that basically tries to diffuse those personal aspects, those personal parts of divinity, those personal ways we have of responding to the world, how we are encouraged not to respond in emotional ways, how we are encouraged not to feel, how we are encouraged not to express our own individual visions? How is that very similar to what the culture did in terms of taking these Native American peoples, these peoples who had a very different way of looking, who were very close to the land, who had very personal relationships, how we tried to remove them, not only from the land, but from having any influence on our culture. There seems to be a very direct metaphor there. Not that it's as oppressive as that, but I think it's a real good thing to relate what we experience with Black Elk to what we experience with our own identity, how we can kind of watch that all evolve. I keep talking about metaphor, and I'm going to say it over and over again until you guys are really going to have red ears from saying it, but every time we experience something in this class, it's designed to encourage you to understand how that is metaphorical to yourselves as individuals. When we look at parts of our culture or pieces of art that our culture produces, intrinsically in those things are metaphors for understanding who we are and how we came to be. Some of them will speak to you, some of them won't. We are all individuals, as well as we all have some degree of commonality. So on your own, try and make connections. Try and see how the greater experience of Black Elk or the greater experience of Russell Baker, which is easier for us to see in ourselves, actually relates in some ways. And express that in the journal or talk about it, if you will. Black Elk says some pretty damning things about the culture we came from. And it's a real important thing to kind of explore the differences between them. Later on, I don't know if we'll do it today or if we'll do it tomorrow, we'll talk about what is the same about Russell Baker and what is different about the Russell Baker and Black Elk. We'll kind of compare and contrast them. So you might even think about that yourself as you're going through it. Are there any other questions? Sometimes I talk so much that I stop people from asking questions. Yeah.
I really think about that question a lot, like what you're saying about what society, why did they encourage you not to think about these things, and I kind of see where they forced it upon the Indian by taking that away from them, but I try to think why and I can't come up with reasons why the society does it so much.
What I thought about was the idea of Russell Baker asserting himself over his mother by cruelty in the Latin lessons, and his white man kind of also asserting himself through cruelty and asserting his independence over the Indians, in a sense. And, you know, I think that in a sense that they were here first, you know, that they were spread out all over the place, and maybe we were a little afraid of some sort of spiritual superiority or something that they had, or that you were talking about before. And it had to be, you know, through that cruelty that, you know, we asserted ourselves.
But they might have been cruel acts, like Russell's, his, with the Latin lessons with his mother. I don't think Russell, at the time, knew that he was being cruel, nor did America at the time think of themselves as being cruel. We called it white man's destiny. We thought there was relative at that time where we were doing the right thing and putting these Indians in their place to educate them in the proper way. And by God, saying these silly songs.
Well, they're not even songs.
Yeah, the name of the party, the chanting and the place of ghost spirits. It's all very relative. It seems to be very relative, and that's what makes it tricky for us. I think where we, in our living life, we don't see the cruel acts we do, because we're relative in our own culture, and we go on every day-to-day life. And it's only when we can look back and see
in some ways, Todd, I think that's very true. But in other ways, I think that we don't see our cruelness because we choose not to look at it. Not that we don't know it's there. I find it real hard to believe when soldiers in Wounded Knee went and annihilated women and children and left them bleeding in the snow that they didn't realize they were committing a cruel act. I'm sure that they made the Indians more like animals in their minds, so it made it easier for them to do consciously. I'm real doubtful that they weren't unconsciously aware of it. And I think most, like talking about South Africa, most of us know what's going on there, and most of us don't like it. What do most of us do, and why don't we do it? When you think about Nazi Germany, we think about how America and Canada and most of the European nations knew what was going on there 12, 15 years before most of the rest of us, the people knew what was going on and did nothing. Why? And the why is not a political question. And I'm not even sure the why is a moral question. The why is a spiritual question. And the question is not spiritual in terms of living up to a dogma. It's spiritual in terms of using that as a metaphor. If that meant something, it didn't mean that we were wrong or they were wrong. What it meant is there's a lesson to be learned in terms of the way we look and respond to the world. What is that message? It's not a question of right and wrong. It's a question of our relationship to the earth, to each other, into whatever our personal divinity is. So looking back at Black Elk is a real good way of kind of analyzing that for ourselves, seeing how that comes to play. One thing about Black Elk that I feel I have to mention here is that when I read the book, I thought he was being amazingly generous to us. First, to share the story at all, and second, because I think he has a fairly balanced view. I mean, he doesn't consider us devils. Boy, if I were live there, I think I probably would. It'd be real difficult for me to overcome my resentment. In fact, the only hostility he seems to have at the end of the book is toward himself.
Mm-hmm. I thought that when they explained that what Wacious was, the term that they used for us, it had nothing to do with our color. There was never like, and even then it wasn't, I mean, he still, like, he joined the Buffalo Bill show, and you know, I mean, and stuff, but it wasn't so much that he just didn't see things drawn like that at all, and I just thought that was amazing, because it would have been so easy to say, but you saw what color, the people who come into our villages and kill our people, you saw what color they were, and but that wasn't what was important. Even the black, they talked about the black cavalry people, and they were colored Weishis. We were all just a different culture. It wasn't a different color. It was just something that for him didn't even exist. Jim?
It's kind of weird that the way that the Indians named themselves, why they wouldn't name us the white men. That's obviously things different set apart from them. You know, they like to call themselves running deer.
What you're saying is they don't stereotype the way we do.
Maybe.
Well, but their names are not what they look like. I mean, you don't. It's the personality. I mean, you're not calling them. I don't think their name because of their physical appearance, it's because of their personality. And I don't think that the white man is not the only difference. The differences are so great that it's one of the minor differences for our cultures. And I can see why they missed it. I mean, why they missed it. Why they didn't emphasize it the way we did. Because, it was such a minor difference. They were so different.
It seems Black Elk was hesitant. I mean, he wouldn't kill animals hunting and that type of thing, but there was no mention of any remorse or any sadness about the killing of the fleshers. It's almost like he didn't consider them. I mean, there were his people, I mean, the Indians, there were the animals, and there were the plants, and they were all sacred, but the Weishu was just not a part of that world. I mean, it's like, you know, it didn't matter to kill the animals. I didn't detect any sadness about, you know, anything like, they're attacking us, we have to kill them. I don't really want to, but we have to, or something like that. This didn't seem to matter.
Of course, they also did the same with other tribes, the wars they had, the wars with the Crow, for instance.
Yeah, war making was a fine art, highly developed among the Plains people. It's very much part of their culture. I think we should move on to Betty at this point.
Okay. We have lots of time for that, so that'd be all right if we did that. Now, we'll get back to all this stuff. Of course, we have a lot more ground to cover. One thing I want to say before Betty comes out here is just the idea of dreams. I said this briefly before, but I'll say it one more time. She's going to talk about her personal experience with the healingness of dreams. And Black Elk talks about the dream world as being the real world, and all the rest as being kind of shadow of that. And although some of us can have a kind of sentimental or emotional feeling about that we say, oh yeah, right, that sounds pretty neat, and all the rest of that stuff, we, because of our culture, don't really accept that. We may get to the point where we can accept the idea that dreams are important and significant. They can solve some problems, they can give us insights, they can help us get closer to our personal divinity, but they really are just sort of a side issue. And I think what Black Elk experience was that's where all information came from. That's where everything starts. In fact, I think the division between a waking world and a dream world was a very small one. Mm-hmm. How many of us have been to extended camping trips raise your hand, really extended, like 3, 4, 5 days. When you're there and you're camping out and you're sort of getting sleep when you need it and waking up at the other time, there's a certain kind of unity that the world starts having. And you find yourself, even as you're hiking down the trail, practically being asleep in a kind of meditative state. Imagine if you could spend your whole life in that kind of reality, where everything seems to kind of be thrown together in a way where time is different, where what you understand and causal relationships are different, how you deal with your relationship with people are very different. That's more like the closest we can get to that kind of experience of what how the Indian, the Native American, I don't like using the word Indian, that's what I remember now, how they saw their world. And there's a lot more of that going on now. There's a real reawakening of the power of dreams, not just so we can cure our neurotic tendencies, but so they can really heal us as whole people. So I'd like Betty to talk about that if she's with. Oh, there you are.
How about right here?
Yeah, right here. On that empty chair. Waiting for you.
I'm really nervous about this. It's not that you guys scare me. It's just that when I talk about things like this, I usually go on a one-to-one basis because that is really easy for me. But to relax reminds me of the time when I was a little kid and I stuttered. I mean, I stuttered so bad that I couldn't even say a sentence. And so this teacher worked with me in the seventh grade. And in the seventh grade, you know, it's really heavy for kids because you're so embarrassed about the way you look and the way you act and everything sometimes. And so he used to tell me to take a deep breath and relax, you know. And I'd get up there and I'd start a sentence. And it would probably take me 10 minutes to get through the sentence. It was that bad. But he worked with me so much that it really, and I knew I was going to be healed of this because I already asked the Lord to heal me. And he said he would, but just when he was going to do this, I didn't know. Because I knew my time wasn't the Lord's time. And so I had to do everything I could to get over this, and then the Lord would take over. And so this is the philosophy that I've always lived by. So anyway, what I'd like to hit on is this one dream that I was talking to Lori about was thought I, this is all I would have to share with you people. But in order to share that, I have to go back into my life and share many other things. And so I would like to hit on dreams and visions and feelings and struggles and some repressed emotions. In fact, that's the reason I'm up here. First, let me take you to a spiritual journey, okay? I can say anything I want to, he says, so I'm just going to kind of relax and just kind of talk off the top of my head. When I was 9 years old, I accepted the Lord as my personal Savior. And my sister was there. It was one of these times when the pastor said, does anybody want to accept the Lord as their personal Savior? Come up the altar, you know. And so I'd been going to Sunday school and Wednesday evening. And this Jesus really excited me, but I didn't know why. And so when I went up and accepted him, and I went outside, and I heard this beautiful music. And I looked up. Now, this is a vision. And I didn't realize it until years later because I kind of hid it in my heart and didn't tell anybody. And I haven't shared this with too many people. And I looked up, and I seen these angels singing. And I poked my sister and I said, hey, do you hear that? And she says, what? Well, I said, all that singing. And I said, look. Of course, by the time we looked back, there was no angels there. So at that, I felt that the Lord really loved me, that I was really important. And I think that's the way he wants all of us to feel. So my first dream was when I was, at least when I remember, because I didn't keep a journal, and so I can't go back and recall. But since I've been up here, I have kept a journal, and because of this journal, I'm able to go back and complete, which has really been neat. On my first dream, I was laying in my bed, and there was a big hole inside my bed. And there was snakes coming up out of this hole, and I was pulled toward this hole. And I never got over totally to the hole, and I never fell. I was glad about that. But when I woke up, I tried to rationalize, why did I dream this? And I was aware very young that being obedient to the Lord is really important. And I had to discipline myself in a lot of areas. And so what had happened the night before was I had put these shoes on because I didn't want my brother to take them, so I wore them to bed. And I was raised by my mother, and there was 9 of us. And as I look back, I didn't think we were poor, but Salvation Army and the churches had to bring us clothes on Christmas and the neat days like that, you know. And I thought that was neat that everybody shared. Well, some of my sisters and brothers didn't think that was so neat. So anyway, they had brought these pair of shoes, and they were high-top shoes, and I just loved them. and so does my brother. And they were boys' shoes. And I put them on and laced them up, and they kept trying to take these shoes off of me. So I told them I was going to wear these shoes to bed. And so I wore these shoes to bed, and I had this dream. And to me, this dream was saying, gosh, I was a selfish person, you know, and I've always remembered that. So as time went on, I feel that dreams now are an extension of oneself, played out in many different characters. And usually these are unresolved emotions. I'm saying this because this is the way I feel with my life, okay? A year ago, I knew I had a lot of repressed emotions that I wasn't dealing with, and I've always been a workaholic, and sometimes workaholics are worse than alcoholics, because on workaholics, you repress all your negative emotions, and they're going to bubble up somewhere. Well, last winter, I took off from work, and I took the whole winter and just decided what I was going to do with my life. I was in a stage of my life where I'd been single for 6 years, and my kids were gone, and that was really traumatic for me, my kids being gone. In fact, I had to talk to a couple of psychologists when I went to college about this, because when I knew it was going to happen, I wanted to be prepared. You never can get prepared. It was really a dramatic thing for me. And I went into not really a depression stage, but a stage where, what's the sense of life anymore? You know, I have no purpose. And so, as I was dealing with this, I knew that I wanted to get away. I couldn't deal with in the area that I was. And in thinking about this, I had a real hunger for the Lord. So I thought, gosh, if he needs to go someplace where, you know, where I could talk all this over with the Lord, and he could work this out, and so I could just take care of him and strive to be a whole person. So in this, I was talking to this gal, and she was telling me about Holden. I thought, gosh, Lord, you know, that'd be a neat place to go. So I did everything I could to come up here. And then I let the Lord take over. Well, I was accepted for 4 months in Tate Ministry where I wanted, because the reason I wanted Tate Ministry is so I could listen to all the sessions. I wasn't going to miss anything. So one of my heavies in coming up here was with, I was struggling with rejection. I'd been divorced 3 times, my first husband. I was married to him 3 years, my second 15 years, and my third one 2 years. And my third one was my heaviest. And he's the one that I had a dream about. And so as I was dealing with these rejections, the psychologist said I was rejected by my father. And because I married alcoholic husbands, I felt rejected by them. So the pattern continued. And I think, well, why did I allow that pattern to continue? Well, once you divorce in the society that I felt I lived in at the time, divorce was really a no-no. I mean, you were really a bad person if you divorced. And if you divorced and had children and didn't remarry, I mean, you were still on the outskirts of society. So having this and having the idea that I tend to mother, and so they say this is why I'm married alcoholics, because I seem to want to mother somebody. And also, I think I married because the way I was raised, that sex out of marriage was a sin. And so how could I have sex if I wasn't married? I mean, that was very logical. So that means I had to marry. And so with these ideas, I pushed on in life. It was heavy. The next dream I had that I remembered was I was on this big, kind of like an observatory. It was a huge building, and there was cement all the way around. And in the middle of this cement, there was a chair. And this chair was like, when I was in school, we had the chairs with the arms that all came around here. And this chair was sitting in the middle. And the Lord told me to go over and sit in it, and that I would rise, and I would float around in the heavens as long as I had faith. And when I didn't have faith, I would come down. And so I trusted. I got in his chair, and we started floating up. And sometimes I would hang on to the chair, and I would start to go down. And I'd go, oh, no, Lord, okay. I believe, I'd go all these things in my mind, you know. And I would start rising again. And when my dream came to an end, I was skidding along the earth with snakes coming up at me. And snakes to me at that time meant the devil. And so I had to look at my life and say, okay, what am I doing? Well, what I was doing is that I had just divorced my second husband and I was living with a man, something that I would never have done if I had thought about it earlier. It was just something that you just don't do. Okay, I was doing something that I really didn't believe in. You know, but sometimes when you do that, that ego is exciting. And that was kind of exciting to me to live with this man. Even though I told him, no, that he couldn't move in. And he says, well, then I'll leave. I'll go live with somebody else. I mean, I had to make a choice. And so I let him move in. And so I felt that the Lord was telling me to get my life squared away. And I said, Lord, just give me time. You know, I told this man about this dream, and I asked him if he'd leave, and he wouldn't leave. And so that made it really bad, because how could I just kick him out? So having trouble with my identity, which I've realized a lot of these things since I've been up here, is that I've always been really close to my mother. And my mother's always caused a lot of problems in my marriage, like a pull between a husband and a mother. And I didn't realize till I come up here that my identity, that I didn't really know who I was. That I had become so much a part of my mother in the things that I thought, that it was like I was living her life. And I struggled to become myself, and actually not knowing where to start or anything. In fact, I wasn't really aware of it until I went home Thanksgiving. And my oldest son, which is 27, I'll try not to jump around too much. I had five kids, and my oldest is 27, and they go down every 2 years. And my fifth one, he would have been 20 this year, and he died when he was 2 months old. And my oldest son said to me, well, Mom, I'd like to come up to Fulton and live up there around you. And this about threw me for a loop, because I always figured my kids didn't want to live around me, because who wants to live around their mother? I mean, I never wanted to live around my mother, but every place I went, my mother always followed me. So I was a good daughter, and I was going to take care of my mother. And she's an invalid, semi-invalid, and she takes care of her great-great-grandson, because to have a child not around her means that she has no purpose in life. So looking at her life and looking at my life, I could see, yeah, that's the way I thought that, because of my mother. And so I really, that's one of my struggles now, to be aware of my identity. And let me tell you, it's heavy. It's really heavy. And when you go into these struggles where you want the healing, you go into a mental and a physical state of where you're just totally exhausted. And I cry a lot, and I talked to the Lord about my tears about 10 years ago, and I said, you know, hey, Lord, can't you just take these tears away? Because they get in the way. And he kept telling me, those tears are for your healing. And I said, well, that's dumb, Lord, because when I cry, I can't talk, and so how are they healing me? Well, I didn't know until I come up here that what he said 10 years ago was really true, because now when I go into a healing, into an area that I desire healing, I tend to really cry. But in the crying, I have to acknowledge this, and I have to offer whatever it is to struggle up to the Lord and ask him to heal me. And then I find my peace. And this is the way that the Lord works with me. Getting back to rejection, when I first came up to Holden, I knew the Lord was going to deal with me in this area. And before I got off the bus, a gentleman took my hand and to help me down. And from that hand, that feeling, I felt rejected. And so even before I set foot on Holden soil, I felt rejected. And I thought, boy, Lord, you're really going to work in this area, I can tell. And so I had to confront this person with this in the way I felt, because I felt when I come up here, I was going to be very confrontive. Because I desired healing so bad that I was going to do my part to get it. And so I told him about this, and he said he was really sorry because I felt that way. And I didn't feel peace about it until one Sunday at Euclid, when everybody hugged. Well, he came up and hugged me, and that was the healing I did. And it was so beautiful. It was just exciting. I'm going through a lot of struggles now. One of my main ones is in music. Besides struggling through my identity, I've never been a person to listen to a lot of love music. And I didn't know why until one day a cassette was put on in the tape room on love music, and I started crying. I said, okay, Lord, what's the problem here? So I realized that when I heard this music, that it brought back a lot of rejection and sadness and desires that were unfulfilled. And so this was really exciting to me, because now that I know this, I can deal with it. Before, I didn't know it. So that's what's neat about healing. It isn't that you're totally healed there at that minute in that area. Many times you struggle through this, and you have to work through these areas. It was just like at Christmas time, Elmer had this tree that he put up. Now, I've been really trying in my emotions not to repress them. And so when I went over and I seen Elmer's tree, he asked me what I thought. And I said, the lights are pretty. And I thought, now that isn't being very, it isn't helping me, because I was repressing what I was feeling. And so I had to go back to him. I said, Elmer, the tree is the ugliest tree I've ever seen in my whole life. But Elmer, he loved his tree. He really loved his tree. And I looked at, and that happened one evening. And this next morning, I got up and I thought about that ugly tree. And I thought, you know, Lord, that's just, I compare that tree with me. Sometimes I feel really ugly, and the Lord really loves me. And that helped me feel really good. And then I could help understand why Elmer loved his tree. I'm struggling too with my sexuality. That's always been a biggie for me. But when I was a little kid, I used to think, boy, I wish I was a boy. My brothers get to do everything, and we have to stay in the house and do all the housework. They get to play ball and da-da-da-da. And so I don't think I've ever really accepted my sexuality, and I'm dealing with it. And it's really a heavy area for me. We had a Thai vespers, and that was really touching for me. It was where we had it over the hotel, and you put blankets down, and you could sit in any position you want to, and there was candles there, and they would chant. And I thought, Lord, I've always wanted to prostrate myself before you, so I'm going to do it. So I got over in the corner, and I laid out flat on my face. And I was, and what started coming to me was my pride. The Lord's been really dealing with me, this area of pride and despair. And so this came to my mind, and as I was dealing with this, I could feel no relief. And so I said, okay, Lord, I'll just offer all my despair to you, all my unworthiness, because I felt very unworthy. And so when I got home, I cried too much, my eyelids were swollen. I mean, that was really heavy for me. But in this getting this all out, I had this vision, and in this vision, I laid at the foot of God, broken like a broken vessel, very unworthy. And as I laid there, a sense of worthiness came over me. And it was so awesome. I just want to share that with you. So anyway, back to the third husband. He's been a real heavy for me. 9 years since I first met him. We lived together a year, 2 years we were married. And when I lived with him, I felt that because I accepted him into my household, that I would marry him. Or he probably didn't think that. So anyway, he had a heart attack. And so he asked me if I'd marry him. And so what else could I do? I felt I should marry him because I lived with him. And so we got married, and he was the type of man that needed more than one honey around. And so he would always go out and have his little affairs out there. And this is something that I couldn't handle at the time. And so I repressed it constantly. I joined this church, and I was being counseled by this pastor. One day, when I went to church, I had this vision, and on this altar stood all these women. I mean, there were hundreds of these women. And the Lord told me, go home and ask your husband to forgive you. He always tells me to do things that I don't want to do. So I was in an area of my life where I'd done everything that I thought I could do, and so I always left the easy things to the Lord. But now I had to leave the hard things, Lord, because I didn't know what else to do. So I went home, and he was laying on the couch, reading his book, watching TV. And I went up and I said, you know, honey, I'm really sorry for all the bad things I think about you, because you've gone out on me so many times and with all these women. But I forgive you because the Lord told me to forgive you. And he looked at me and said, what are you talking about? And that was it. So I said, okay. I knew then that eventually I would have to divorce him. I didn't want to divorce him because I was about 40 and I didn't think I'd have another chance for marriage. And I didn't want to go through life alone. So that was kind of the fear with me. So as time went on, I knew that it had to be. So we divorced. I seen him about a year after that, twice. He came to the house and he knocked at the door and said, you got a cup of coffee? And I said, okay. So he come in and we talked. And then that was in Idaho. And then I moved to Walla Walla. Because in Idaho, my mother wasn't there. But anyway, I moved back to Walla Walla and he came back late at night, about 4 o'clock, really zonked out of his mind, and asked if he could come in and have a cup of coffee. And I said, no. So he staggered back to his car and left. And that was the last time I seen him. And that was over 6 years ago. And I've been struggling with this man. His life said he had a chain around my neck, and I didn't know how to release him. So here comes the dream of release. We were sitting on a beach, and he got mad at me, and if you know anything about alcoholics, they always get mad at you. I mean, they don't have to have a reason to get mad at you. And so he left, and he says, I'm going to go find me another little honey. And so as my dream continued on, I was getting ready to leave, and he come over to me, and I put my hand up to him, and I said, can we still be friends? He reached his hand out and he touched me. And in that touch, there was nothing. I mean, there was no feeling. And I got so excited because I knew I had released him. I had totally released him. After 9 years, I had released this man. And I woke up. I mean, I was shouting hallelujah and praise the Lord every day. I found out later, Thanksgiving, when I went home, found out he died. And he died the day after I had had that dream. And I was so thankful that I had that dream, that I released him, not that he was taken away from me. You know, so this was a super healing in my life. And this was what I was so excited about when I was talking to you. So I've had other visions. My most recent one is when I was jogging down this way from the from the trail or from the road here, and I looked up, and I heard this I heard this loud voice in, to my west here, and it said, "You are my child," you know, and it was like the Lord was just screaming this out at me, you know, and I just said, "I am your child." He repeated, "You are my child," you know. I thought, boy, if he has to tell me that like that, I know I'm going to go see some heaven. Because that was my highlight. And when you have a real high plateau up here, you know you're going to go through some low ones because you hang on to that high one while you're in the low ones. So that was a kicking. is there any questions?
Usually the positions when you're asleep or like I thought you were most asleep when you were running down.
Yeah, it depends. Usually the vision will come, you know, when I am awake, that usually is a vision, and then you would tend to go into a dream, but not always.
Did I see something? Did you see
okay, the vision I had just before this other one with the Lord was I was coming along here and I looked up and I seen a nice fluffy cloud up there and I thought, guys, that's not like the cloud that the Lord's going to come on my bed, you know? And as I looked at it, it shaped itself into a fish. And all I thought was Jesus Christ, Savior. And I mean, that was when I was awake and when I saw it. That's all I could say. There is something that's kind of a poem I'd like to share with you if you don't have any more questions.
I do. Okay, I guess I'm gonna do you think that everybody has visions or do you think that it's just the way that the Lord's chosen to talk to you that's the way you have to, I don't know, I guess.
Yeah. I feel I think he works with all of us different and this is just the way that he works with me. And I don't know why. I don't know if anybody knows why he deals with each other differently. Probably because that's the way I could understand.
Could it be, do you think, just because you're willing to accept it? Because I think if I thought I heard a voice off to the right, I would think that somebody was up there talking to someone else or something, and I wouldn't even ever consider that I was hearing the voice of God.
I was baptized in the Spirit quite some time ago, and because of this, I've been very aware of the Holy Spirit in my life. And I read my Bible usually twice, once in the morning and once at night, and I feel like I'm constantly talking with the Lord. And sometimes to know somebody, you know, you have to learn about him. And I really have this hunger to learn about the Lord. And maybe this is why he could feel these things to me in this way. I don't know. Oh, one other thing. In dealing with the death of my child, I've never been able to deal with that. That's been 20 years ago. And I've never been able to deal with that until this summer, where, you know, you talk about a ceremony, going through a ceremony type thing. I never went through that with my child. I never really cried it out. I come up to this summer. And so that was another really a good thing for me. And a lot of these things that your kids talk about here are things that I can say, yeah, I've been there. I know what you're saying, you know, because they're really active in my life right now. So what I want you to do is I want you to put things that you've got in your back and I want you to hang on to hand. I need everybody to hang on to something here.
I think that's really interesting that you just said that because a lot of your visions come, I mean, you just said to grab hands and touch is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, when I heard this, the thing I'm going to read to you, that's good if you can see the circle. I heard it on a tape, and this gentleman was here in 1977, and when I heard this on this tape, I just really started crying because I thought, wow, Lord, you really have a lot more dealing to do with me. And so as I read it, I'd like you to close your eyes and as you think of every spell. Please hear what I am not saying. Don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the face I wear, for I wear a mask. I wear a thousand masks, and masks that I'm afraid to take off, and none of them are me. Pretending is an art that is second nature with me. But don't be fooled, for God's sake, don't be fooled. I give you the impression that I am secure, that all is sunny and unruffled within me and also without. That confidence is my name and coolness is my game. That the water's calm and I'm in command. That I need no one. But don't believe me, please. My surface may seem smooth, but my surface is my mask. My ever-varying, my ever-concealing mask. Beneath lies no smugness or complacency. Beneath dwells a real me in confusion, in fear, in aloneness. But I hide this. I don't want anybody to know. I panic at the thought of my weakness and fear of being exposed. That's why I frantically create a mask to hide behind, a nonchalant, sophisticated facade to help me pretend, to shield me from the glance that knows. But such a glance is precisely my salvation, my only salvation, and I know it. That is, if it's followed by acceptance, if it's followed by love. It's the only thing that can liberate me from myself, from my own self-built-up prison walls, from the barriers that I have so painstakingly built, the only thing that will assure me that I cannot assure myself, that I am really worth something. But I don't tell you this. I don't dare. I'm afraid to. I'm afraid that your glance will not be followed by acceptance and love. I'm afraid that you'll love me less, that you will laugh, and your laugh will kill me. I'm afraid that deep down I'm nothing, that I'm just no good, that you will see this and reject me. So I play my game, my desperate pretending game with a facade of assurance without and a trembling child within. And so begins the parade of masks, the glittering but empty parade of masks, and my life becomes a false front. I idly chatter to you in a suave tone of surface talk. I tell you everything that is really nothing, and nothing of what's crying within me. And so when I'm going through my routine, do not be fooled by what I'm saying. Please, listen carefully and try to hear what I'm not saying, or what I would like to be able to say, or what survival I need to say, but what I cannot say. I dislike hiding, honestly I do. I dislike the superficial games that I'm playing, the superficial phony games. I really would like to be genuine, spontaneous, and me, but I've got to have help. You alone can break down those walls behind which I tremble. You alone can remove my mask. You alone can release me from the shadow world of panic and uncertainty, from my lonely prison. So don't pass me by. Please, please don't pass me by. It will not be easy for you. The long convictions of worthlessness build up strong walls. The nearer you approach to me, the blinder I may strike back at you. I'm irrational, but despite that, what the book says about irrationality, I fight against everything that I cry out for. But I am told that love is stronger than these walls, and that in this lies my hope, my only hope. Please try to beat down those walls with firm hands, but gentle hands. For the child is very sensitive. Who am I, you may wonder? I am someone you know very well. For I am every man and every woman and every child you meet. I am the person whose hand you are holding.
Talk about it?
Yeah.
not a, I was kind of stepping back outside of myself while she was talking, kind of observing myself to what was going on. And I found that it was funny because when we were talking about the cultural barriers with music and the music, you know, that was kind of like a good lead into this, because I found I had a harder time, in a way, believing that the things actually happened and that they happened to me would I believe they happened for real. You know, and I think it's just through all the cultural things of our culture that have built up. And even though it's hard for me to do that, I struggled because I stepped out. I think as she was talking more and more, I was able to accept it more. And so it was just interesting the struggle that was going on within me.
How many other people felt that same kind of struggle? Anyone else not wanting to admit it? I'm just curious. That'd be sort of common. What do you suppose that struggle is? What is it? Why are we, or some of us, afraid to accept the fact that information, important information, divine information, can come from very personal other sources?
Just too intimate a contact. If we're that close, how can we hide? I mean, by doing that, we realize that, you know, there is a reason that we have all these facades and masks that she was talking about there, and protect something that we feel about ourselves that shouldn't be seen. And if someone can talk to us that directly, then they must be able to see through all the masks. So we're kind of unwilling to admit that somebody can talk to us that way. Because to do that, we have to admit that our masks aren't really working very well.
I think in a lot of ways, listening to her, I kind of felt cheated because I don't have that type of relationship. And it's like almost saying, how come her faith is better than mine? How come she's experiencing this thing and I'm not? How come God isn't doing this to everybody?
I'll get back to that one. See what you want.
I feel almost hearing this is almost an attack on my faith, and that my faith isn't as worthwhile as hers because I don't have these experiences, and I almost want to deny her experiences because I don't have them, and I know the quality of my faith in that. And because she has that and I don't, I want to say, wait a minute, and that's hard for me to accept both.
Mm-hmm. Does anyone else want to comment about that? I don't want to truncate anyone's experience, but I have my own answer for that question. I think that it's not so much that we have to look for a reaffirmation of our faith to come from some other source, as much as we have to look at the way we live our lives and be affirmed by it, by looking at it. When I talk about metaphor, and I talk about our lives as a metaphor, I think that's what I talk about, in the sense of if we agree that, if we have a belief and that we want to see that belief affirmed in our lives, what we need to do is to start looking at ourselves instead of looking for an affirmation. Because in our lives, if our life is a metaphor for it, we will find that affirmation in small ways. Maybe the way we lift up a coffee cup, as it is with myself sometimes. Or perhaps the way what we see in other people, or just the way our leg moves at a particular point, or anything very small. Betty said that God speaks to people very differently. So rather than be in competition, to think that we have to be like somebody else or somebody else is better than us, I would think that what we need to do then is look harder at what we are, thereby finding that divinity within us. That's sort of what we try and do in the class in some ways. And what was mentioned, I think Tom mentioned it about that sort of shell, that cracking of that shell. Freud called it the ego. That's the one, the word that most of us have accepted for that sort of individuality. Now, individuality is so strong that we interpret it in a lot of ways as being competitive, as being me versus the rest, or me versus them, or us versus them, or the sort of constant battle or struggle. And most of us, whether we accept it or not, look at life as being a struggle, a battle, a constant way of reaffirming ourselves. In the process, we negate everybody else. I expect there's a way of being able to reaffirm ourselves in our differences and our samenesses without having to steal somebody else's affirmation. And there lies your own identity. And that's sort of what the Course is trying to uncover in some very, very small way. And I'm real glad Betty was here to share that, because in some way she gave us a very personal point of view about the very general experience that we're attacking. There's that word again.
There are some common experiences that you may have that Betty has lived through. Why do you decide to marry someone? What are the reasons? Why do you decide to be in a relationship? Why do you choose to get out of one? How do you feel about yourself? All of those things that she talked about regarding your own identity, whether it be sexual or whether it be relationship to the earth.
I want to share one personal note here. I mean, I'm not Christian, as some of you may have observed or figured out. And the context that you're talking about receiving spirit or information in different ways is something that I go through every day here because of the context of what Holden's about. That doesn't deter me, or that doesn't keep me from being open, or it doesn't keep me from appreciating and respecting and emotionally responding to the kind of experience that Betty talks about, or whatever our own personal experience is, and what Black Elk's experience is as well. His experience of his own divinity and what God's message is to him is a different one, but it is nonetheless powerful. And it seems to me that one of the wonderful things for me to be here is the sense of diversity. How many of us in our lives will experience God in our own way and instantly negate it for the next person's experience, no matter what it is. What seems to me the thing that makes this world such a wonderful place is the capacity to experience that spiritual message in a variety of ways and have it come out in a variety of cultures and be able to not repress those others and not let others mean that yours may not be right, that the experience becomes a very personal one. When you can do that, when the experience becomes a personal one, you are no longer afraid. You're no longer afraid of your own message. You're no longer afraid of being in another environment where everyone's going to feel differently than you. So I think in that sense, I just wanted to add that one little thing, which is something that you don't often get at PLU, because the message you get is mostly the same with very subtle variations.
But this relates to a sort of, might we call it, faith imperialism. Much like how we responded when the rope was there and you were moving in. It's the same thing. Do you negate someone else, or do you endear yourself to them, come closer to them, and add them in as part of your vocabulary? So we do that a lot, not only in our daily lives, but also in our spiritual lives. What do we believe, and do we shut other people out because they're different?
Yeah.